Want to introduce Bev to you, our speaker. She is our senior elder's wife, and she is also a counselor here on staff at Xenos. She's been working with kids for 38 years in different ways or another, and she also has two grown girls of her own. And so she understands a lot about how God has designed us. I love the verse in Psalms 139 about how we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And I think it's really neat to be able to kind of scan back and look at our kids through God's eyes, that He created them, He designed them, He has a purpose for their life. And as we try to understand them a little bit better through these personalities that God's given them, it will help give us a vision for them and a hope for them, and to realize that, you know, maybe some of the things that we find frustrating about them is really something that God's really going to use in their life. So I'm going to introduce Beth. Yes, why don't we open up with some prayer first. God, we're so grateful that you are involved in our lives, that you care about our parenting, and that you are our helper, that you give us insight through your word and through others. And we just really pray for this morning that you would help us walk away with one nugget of truth, God, that you know where each of us are at with parenting. You know each of our kids. And we just really pray, God, that you give us a vision for them and how we can help develop them into who you've made them to be, God. And we just really thank you for this. And we just pray that we can hear from you this morning, God. Amen.
Thank you. All right, I want to make sure I'm back far enough to see everyone in the corners. It is great to be here. Of all the things that I do, parenting and talking about parenting is one of my favorite things. It's right up there. The discussion of parenting is right up there with the discussion of sex for me. And so I love to talk about both. And I also have to be careful because I was warned I'm being taped and they don't want to edit too much. So I'll try to be careful here. It's great to see so many parents care enough about their children that they want to come and have knowledge to learn how to be better parents. There is a lot of it out there for us. And so it's just great to be here. Today, I want to talk about your children's personalities. We want to understand our kids. We want to appreciate their differences. And we want to know how to develop their unique person that they were created to be. They're, I'm sorry. Let me get my glasses on. We all know that kids are different. We all know that some are as fearless as they can be, and we gasp our breath hoping they make it to two alive. Some are so fearful that we have to kind of push them out. You know, we know some are outgoing, some are shy. But so what? What impact, if any, should this have on our parenting? It is important. And next to the Bible, I believe that this has been one of the most helpful bits of knowledge and information that I've had for parenting. Yes, from the Bible, we have a source of truth. The Bible claims that it is written by God Himself, who claims to be our Creator. And so it is a manual on truth and wisdom, on what kind of values we should have for our children and what kind of character traits should we develop in them. But this study of your child's personality will tell you how that's going to be uniquely expressed in each kid, those character qualities and those values. So the goal for this today is to understand the strengths and the weaknesses of each of your children. Every personality has character strengths and character weaknesses. And if we understand the weaknesses and how to interact with them, we're going to save ourselves and our kids a lot of frustrations and concerns. We also want to understand how your child's personality or temperaments, I'll explain why these words are being used interchangeably in a minute, but We want to understand how you and your child's temperaments interact with each other. Because if you're real different, there's going to be a lot of frustrations. We also want to guide your children in establishing realistic goals for themselves. Contrary to popular American belief, your child cannot be anything he or she wants. Not every child can be a star athlete. Not every child can be America's next idol. And so to understand how they're designed and what their strengths and weaknesses are will help you know how to have vision for your kid and help them set realistic goals. Okay, I am using a classification called temperaments. It's a very old classification. I know there's many studies of personalities. Some are more familiar with Myers-Briggs and different newer temperaments. But around Xenos, we have used this classification of temperaments for a long time, and it works for me. It's kind of general, but it's easy and it works. So that's why I've chosen this one. And the temperament study observes how surroundings affects one's feelings, one's intellect, and will. And then which one predominantly determines one's actions. Okay? So this is, you can observe this as you watch toddlers play with each other. And one toddler goes and grabs a toy from another one. All right? One reaction is going to be a scream of bloody murder, looking around to make sure mom's noticing, but as looking as mom sees another bright, shiny toy, and after the bloody scream, they're off with the next toy. Another child, that's one whose feelings are affected. All right. Another one, you'll see cry and cry and cry, and you would think that was the only toy left on the whole universe, and they're not going to stop crying. They need mom's comfort. That's another toddler. Another one will look at the kid like, what's the big deal? You could have asked. And they're off playing with another toy without even being bothered by it. And then, of course, there's the toddler who goes over and just clobbers the kid and takes it back and is off on its way. Okay. This, as we'll see, all of those fit into the different temperaments. Also, I want to say the qualifications that I need to say, okay? Some of us don't like labeling our kids or anybody else. And in Xenos, many, many years ago, we used this, we abused this, we did wrongly label our kids, and they couldn't really get out of a box. We don't want to do that, okay? But it's still important to understand if you want to effectively help your children. So I know there's problems with labeling. Try to lean against them and still take this information in. Another qualification is that no person is just one single temperament. So you're going to see blends, and you're going to be talking, thinking about this. Oh, this is my kid. Oh, this is my kid. Oh, this is my kid. Probably true. Okay? They probably fit into several categories because we're all blends. And the third qualifier is that this is a very general overview. Try to find one good point to take home to make you a better parent. All right. Here's your classifications. There is a sanguine personality, and this one is where emotions are predominant, but they live on the external. They are living in their surroundings and reacting to every new surrounding. This is a kid that won't think first, but will cry, laugh, whatever. Okay, the melancholic is also one whose emotions are predominant, but a melancholic child has an internal focus. Everything comes, you're not going to see it as easily or quickly and you're not going to know what's quite going on until you ask questions, because they live inside their head and their feelings. The choleric is the child whose will is predominant. And then the phlegmatic is the one whose intellect, whose reasoning is predominant. And the phlegmatic child will not really get that upset about too much of anything, because they just kind of reason things out instead of have emotional reactions. So if we go back to our toddlers, the one who screams and then forgets and goes on to the next thing is your sanguine. The one who cries and cries and cries and can't be comforted is the melancholic. The one who just clobbers the kid and takes the toy back, choleric. And the one who doesn't even bother to make a sound and just move on is your phlegmatic child. Now let's look at them individually for a minute. And I start with the sanguine, because it is the greatest. No, I'm only kidding. Guess what temperament I am. All right. But this is your happy, friendly child. This is the toddler that when you put them in the grocery cart at the store, they're asking everybody's name. They are smiling big, making sure they get lots of attention. They are your fun, outgoing kid. All right. They are happy. They are spontaneous. They are empathetic. They are your talkers and talkers and talkers. I had a friend who we got together at my house, and she had a little sanguine daughter. We always met when Gary was at home, because when he was doing yard work or something, we could send Carly out to talk to Gary. And he could keep working, she could keep gabbing, and we could get some conversation done. All right. Also, they're known for their swift mood swings. If you look over on the weaknesses, they are moody and hot-tempered, and they can sound so intense. You're just about ready to call a counselor, because this kid just is sounding like you've scarred them for life. You know, but count to 20, and the mood will be over, and they'll be happy and moving on to something else. Right? That's important to know. Not every personality is like that, but your sanguine is. They are easily distracted, and their mantra in life is, I forgot, I forgot, I forgot. They are disorganized, and they have little impulse control. Okay, and so I had a sanguine daughter who was very interested in the cat's water bowl. At 9 months old, she was still crawling, starting to talk a little bit. And maybe 9 to 12, I don't remember. That was 26 years ago. But she, you know, I didn't want to have to put the water bowl up. I wanted her to know she doesn't get in the water bowl. So I'd say no. I'd say no. I would say no and put her someplace else. I'd just give her a little pat on the hand. That's a no. Give her a bunch of toys in another room. That's a no. This went on and on. And finally, she's crawling and she's shaking her hand and she's saying, no, no. You know, little impulse control. All right. And so this is the sanguine child. They are attention seekers. And even though there's some, you know, little impulse control, so they'll do things, they really are weak-willed in that. Try to get them disciplined, and that's your biggest challenge. Here is what, let me say this. They forget. They're disorganized, and when they tell you they forgot, you believe them. They really did forget. And that is because they live so much in the moment. You know, when you have them right in front of you, that is the only world that's there. One author said that you know, when a sanguine is with you, you are their best friend. And they can love you up and connect with you and so glad to see you. And then the next street corner, you are forgotten and the next person is right there. Okay? So here's what one author says about it. Your little sanguines fully intend to be obedient, and they do want to please, but they get swept away with curiosity or a change of environment. And although many times he seems to be premeditatedly disobedient, he actually is just forgetting the past moment, and engulfed in the present moment. He easily forgets the past punishment and does not consider the problem disobedience may present to him. Why? Because their feelings are so connected in this moment that everything else is forgotten. Okay. All right. We don't want them to keep living this way. It's difficult for them, but you understanding this will help you. So let's deal with the weaknesses. Obviously, we have to help them learn to follow through. If you're a sanguine parent with a sanguine kid, this is hard, but to remember to stand in front of them, eye contact, this is what you need to do. It's not so good to count to three with a kid, a sanguine kid, because by three, they forget what you said and they're, you know, on to the next thing. So give them eye contact, stand in front of them, look at them, and ask them to do it and watch until they follow through. All right? That's when they're younger. They are going to be forgetful all their lives. And so you need to help them come up with their own reminder aids. You know, some parents really like their house organized and they like the book bags in place where they belong, you know, in the closet after school or whatever. I suggest that if you have a sanguine kid, put it right in front of their door so they trip over it, you know, on the way out. And use wristbands, mark their hands with certain whatever, put notes on the front door, but help them learn to come up with their own reminder aids. Please do not keep doing it for them. All right. They have to come up with them themselves. The next one, they must learn to lean against their feelings. A sanguine's feelings are so intense, they will feel like they really are going to die if they don't get what they want, or if they have to say no to themselves. They will try to convince you that you're killing them, and that's fine. We had our little sanguine when she was, I think, a freshman, wanted to go to some dance at school, and she was all excited about the dance. We found out we had to go to Russia during the dance, and we had the chance to take them. So, hey, kids, we're going to Russia. You know, she thought it was going to be the end of her life. And she could not miss this dance. She threatened us that she'd grow up and get on drugs, maybe become a murderer. She guaranteed us she would ruin the whole trip and make it miserable for us. And she kept on this long enough that I began to wonder, you know, we're working in Russia. We do have to get things done. Am I making a good decision? But I remember she's a sanguine and what's going to happen when she gets there. And so we went on and she came with us. And after 4 hours in Red Square, I'm getting a little note in my journal. Sorry, Mom, thanks for having me come. You know, and it was a life-changing experience for her. So help them lean against their feelings and show them the reward of doing that. Teach them healthy fear. They do not have fear of strangers. They do not have fear of adventure. You know, these are the kids that are going to get in trouble not because their dad isn't around enough or you screwed them up. It's just exciting and they get caught up in the moment. So teach them a healthy fear. Teach them to be honest. A sanguine has a value that the other's temperaments do not have, and that is a good story is more important than the truth. They love to embellish. They love to exaggerate. And, you know, it's fine to entertain people, but they really do need to know the difference between truth and their stories. And so my young one had so many stories. When I went down to school, I never knew what I was going to be hit with. Sometimes it was, sorry, your brother died. Sometimes it was, I won't go into that, but then they, you know, even to, somebody came up to me with tears. It's the cutest story, how you got your kitten. How did we get our kitten? We went to the Humane Society and picked out a cat. Yeah. Oh, well, I heard that you were at the circus last night and that this little kitty had allergies and was allergic to the elephants. And that because your daughter had asthma and she could relate and understand, they let you take the kitty home. Yeah. Let's write that story and submit it, but let's not tell it to people as if it was true. All right. We really want to give consequences. And this is great to give consequences that are natural. You know, they forget their homework so much, and you're so concerned that their grades are going to go down, you're tempted to go give them their homework. If they forget it, they suffer the consequences. That is the best way to teach them. And also, consequences are most effective if you're denying them their social activity. All right, this was kind of difficult in our home because I had a child who was very sanguine, who the only thing that was effective was to not let her play with people and her friends. But I had another one who was melancholic, and when she was told she was grounded, it was like, oh, great, I get to go to my room with my book, and I'll stay there 3 days. And so we had to change up the consequences. But for the sanguine, denying their social activity is very important. By high school, my kid was telling me, I've spent my life being grounded. Don't you get it? It doesn't work. And I said, I get it. Tell me what will work. You come up with your own effective discipline. Day later, I said, what'd you come up with? She goes, you know the only thing that will even touch me is if you don't let me be with my friends. I said, I know, so you're grounded. All right. Also, delayed gratification. Help them know that it's okay to wait and to deny themselves this for something greater. We did this with a trip to Disney World where all the allowance that they got, she could spend a little bit, but we kept her saving a big pot, saving for almost 2 years. Then when she got to Disney World, she had money to go shopping, and we tried to make the connection. It worked a little bit, but she still is a sanguine. All right. Help them know that they do make choices. This impulse control problem, they are so quick. The thinking process is so quick. You know, somebody looks bored, I'll be outrageous. And they're doing something insane, getting up on the teacher's desk and making fun of the teacher. You know, stuff that you're like, where does this come from? There is a thinking process, and there are a series of choices they make. And so watching for that and helping them see, all right, this is when the idea came in. This is when you got out of your seat. This is when you stood on the teacher's desk, you know, and help them see that they made choices. Otherwise, they're going to believe that they can't help it. Develop their strengths. These are compassionate people, and you want to deepen that compassion. And when you give them hobbies and interests, that include acts of mercy and compassion, they're going to shine. They're great little kids to take to a nursing home and let them love on older people because they will do it well. Help them actualize their big dreams, but make sure they're realistic. All right. I didn't mean to move that, but I'll keep going, and we'll go on to your choleric. Your choleric is most known. Most people will say your choleric is your leader type. Okay. They are leaders, but there are other temperaments that are leaders as well. But these are leaders not necessarily because they have strong convictions or a great cause. It's just that they realize at a young age, I am going to lead or I'm going to be led, and there's no way I'm going to be led. And so they want to lead just for the sake of leading others and not being led. All right, they are fiercely independent. My sanguine is also a very strong choleric, as the cat story showed, because she, you know, would not quit and give up. I could not teach her any skill. She learned how to tie her shoes all by herself. She learned to dress all by herself. Colors, numbers, all by herself. I tried to teach her reading. I don't get it. Then one day I gave up because I was frustrating her. One day she came in with a book and said, Mommy, sit down, and read me the whole book. All right. I called the teacher, her kindergarten teacher. Did you teach her to read? No, she wouldn't let me. Okay. So she's getting it, and she is still incredibly independent and wants to do things her own way. All right, they are bossy, they're mean, they can be proud, impatient, and crafty. Now, I want Suzanne Wesley, who was the mother of 19 children, and she had two sons who were very famous preachers and hymn writers. They just really rocked all of England and North America. Said, the self-willed child must be broken and brought under subjection before the age of 2. Okay. It is the will of the child, not the spirit, that must be broken. They will fight to the end. My little choleric, you know, also when she didn't get her way, decided she really wanted her way, and so she, at 1.5 or 2, she held her breath until she passed out and went down on the hardwood floor and got a knot on her head. All right. They are determined little creatures. All right. But I want to make a qualifier here. A lot of us think we have strong-willed children, and we do. But a lot of the strong will that we see in our kids is more about the parenting style that we have in America instead of their temperament. All right. We are taught that kids are fragile, that we can mess them up, and so we are overly concerned about hurting their feelings. And we're pretty sensitive to that. We are in a culture where we are indulgent, we're wealthy, and if we have it, why not lavish it on them? Our kids are not used to hearing no that often, especially when they're young and normal. One observation I made about this was when you go to churches, you know, parents are in the back, letting their kids run around, they're walking. You never see kids sitting for an hour next to their parents, quiet. Well, 50 years ago, that's all you saw. Yeah. But it's, and I'm not going to critique which one's better or worse, but that we're not, our kids aren't used to hearing no. And so they look strong-willed, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're a choleric. So how do we know the choleric? A true choleric is fiercely independent, like I said about the reading. There is not just a fight or a fit when they don't get their way. Sometimes they'll even say, okay, because they've already figured out how to get around you and disobey you as soon as you turn your head. Okay. But they are out to win. And then the other thing is that these kids are very busy, fearless, adventuresome types. My choleric, we'd put her to bed. It would be quiet, but she'd crawl out of the crib, and she painted the whole upstairs with Vaseline. Yeah. We would find her out of her diaper, out of her crib, in a pillowcase, sleeping on a step, sleeping out on the balcony. Yeah. She was busy, busy, busy. We tested her for ADHD. She didn't have it. She's just a choleric. All right. How do we deal with our cholerics? You must win their respect, which means you must win the battle with them. And if you believe Suzanne Wesley, before they're two. That might mean 2 hours of staying in the battle with them. Don't worry about crushing their spirit. You're not going to hurt them. You are bigger than them. You are older than them. You are stronger than them. You are smarter than them. Remember that and stay in the battle until you win. You want to win the battle. Another way of winning their respect and winning the battle is that the battle must be with firmness and principle. They're going to try to outsmart you. They're going to use logic on you. That is going to, put you on the defense. Stay on the offense. My choleric would say, "You're just trying to control me. You are trying to control me. You just want to control me." My mantra was, "No, I don't want to control you. I know I can't control you, but you are not going to control me. Just because you don't want to obey the rules of my house, you are not going to force me to change my rules. Because I know they're right, to keep you safe." And so that needs to be stated, reasoned, even if they don't give in and make it hard on you, they will come back and thank you, and it will eventually sink in. So win their respect. You'll do this with consistent consequences. That's hard for a sanguine mom. But consistent consequences is what's going to keep them in line. This will be one of the hardest things for them to do. They must learn to admit when they're wrong, and they must learn to apologize. That is probably the hardest thing in the world for a choleric. Most adult cholerics that I know do not admit that they are wrong, but all of a sudden, after they've been confronted or challenged, then they will ignore it, blow it off. But a week later, they've made a change in their attitude and their behavior. And it's a new idea they just came up with. Yeah. They forget that you told them that a week ago. This is something that, if you can get to there, that's, pretty good. But especially when they're young, get them to apologize. Get them to admit that they're wrong. All right. Help them develop empathy. That is something that really you can't do. You can't make them have feelings of compassion for people. But you can teach them a kind, empathetic response to people. And then if you do that enough, God and His Spirit can begin to work in them and get them, hopefully, feeling some of it someday. That's not ever going to be a strong suit, but it will help. The ability to be grateful and enjoy what is. Once a choleric has accomplished something, they're on to the next thing, the next project, the next goal. And they can be real discouraging to other people because they, you know, don't really want to take the time for praise, for enjoyment, for appreciation of what is. Let's go on to the next thing. And this is a conflict when a choleric spouse marries someone who is different than them. You know, they just feel like you never want to appreciate what's going on. So it's good for them after they've accomplished something, you know, when everybody else in the family wants to celebrate good grades and they're on to, what's the big deal? Come on, let's go. We can make it better. We can do it different. You don't want to discourage that, but you want to balance it out with helping them enjoy. Developing their strengths, they will be leaders. But you want them to be leaders that have a conviction and a cause other than just to have power over other people. And you want them to be able to lead for people's good. Your cholerics need responsibility. There is a great book, and I forgot to put it on the book list, called Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World. And one of the points that it makes is that kids today really have no responsibilities until they're adults. They say that basically they do. They're told behave, get good grades, you know, don't cause trouble, and then they are free. You know, the farm is not dependent on them helping and contributing anymore. We don't need them to do the dishes. The dishwasher does it for them, you know. And so there's really little significant work that kids have today. I believe all kids need that, and it helps them grow. But your choleric children really need it. They need to have projects that they can accomplish, that they can, you know, things that projects that they can do, that they can build. And that if you keep them busy with these kinds of things, you will have less trouble with your choleric. Okay, the melancholic child. The melancholic child is one of your most gifted, most talented, most loyal, most creative, idealistic kids that you'll have. They're awesome. I know that after 28 years of living with one. At first, I thought that this was the, you know, most awful temperament. I was like, who would ever want to be melancholic? And yet, after living with my oldest daughter for 28 years, I can say that this person is an amazing person. Yes, they are negative thinkers, they're perfectionists, they're indecisive only because they want to analyze and analyze and analyze, so it paralyzes them. They are distrustful, fearful, you know, critical, rigid. They're the ones that do not want you to change the nursery. They don't want their new bed. They don't want you to move anything in the house. Okay. They love order and sameness. But they are great kids. All right. But they live inside, and they're not only feeling things deeply, but their mind and their feelings are connected deeply, and so they're thinking things. My oldest, when she first met her uncle, who lived out of state when she was a toddler, I said, so, did you like Uncle Charlie? I don't know. What did Uncle Charlie think of me? She wasn't going to say she liked him until she found out whether he liked her first. Beverly LaHaye says, it's easy for him or her to have her feelings hurt and to feel inferior, believing that others do not like them. And even though he may possess the greatest talents of any of the temperaments, he suffers under the delusion of an inferiority complex. And so, because of his sensitive nature and tendency towards perfection, you must be careful of how you critique. You still want to critique. You want them to get comfortable with criticism and constructive input. But, you know, it's going to look different with your melancholic than with your sanguine or choleric. Okay? Dealing with the weaknesses. Help them accept the imperfections of life. If their little sister colors in their very favorite book, they still can enjoy that book. It's not ruined forever. All right. This is something that is so important for them to understand, that they will make the world better. And that's awesome. And you want to help them keep that vision. But help them see that they can also enjoy things that are not perfect. Keep them talking. It really is amazing what goes on in that head of theirs and how they interpret reality. When my oldest was 2, she was almost 3, but she was 2, we adopted our children, and every night we prayed, and I would pray, thank you, God, for making us a family. Thank you for my precious gift. Thank you for letting me adopt my baby, because I wanted her familiar with that term, so there would never be a time when she didn't know that. But at 2, that was what she knew about adoption. Was that, you know, God allowed me to adopt her. So one day, she heard somebody was in the hospital having a baby, and so she said, Mommy, Penny's gone to the hospital to adopt her baby. And so then I explained very simply, well, you can have a child by birthing and being a birth mom, biological mom, I think I even said, and then, a birth mom can birth the baby, and then you can become an adopted mom. That's enough explanation for a 2-year-old. One night, several months later, when praying, and I said, thank you for adopting me, she said, you just remember, God gave me to my biological mother first, and then he gave me to you. Okay. I'm real glad that came out. We had a lot to talk about. And I said to her, well, yes, honey, he did. And I thought we were going to talk about that when you were about 12, but now that you bring it up, we'll talk about it now. Okay. Be prepared for conversations. Get them talking. They might not want to talk. They're afraid of what you're going to think. These are the kids that I recommend getting one-on-one time with and talking about what they want to talk about. Get them used to having talk time with you. Let there be silence so that they start bringing up the subject. One great author said, talk to kids like this when you're driving in a car or when it's time to go to bed, because they want a way out. If the talk goes bad, they want to know that there's going to be an end. And so, you know, these are kids that whenever they're ready to talk, take the time to talk and find out what's in that head, because they see and experience reality through how it impacts them. Okay. That is their sense of reality. I mean, that's all young people, but they really stick with it. And so my daughter, again, at 2, confronted me. Mommy, you're a liar. Why do you lie to me? Now, why does she think I'm a liar? Because I'm a sanguine, and I forget, and I change my mind because I live in the moment. This drove her crazy, you know. But she it impacted her as I would lie to her. And so that was her conclusion. That was important for me to know. What would have that done to our relationship if I hadn't known that? Also, teach them gratitude. Because they're negative thinkers, because they see the cloud behind every silver lining, because they see the cup half full, they will get stuck in looking at that if you don't help them. Grandma and Grandpa took my melancholic to SeaWorld. She had a fabulous day. On the way out, she wanted to see one more thing, one more time. We didn't have time. It ruined the whole day. She cried. She hated it. She hated Grandma and Grandpa. She hated me. She was miserable. And so we had to learn to play the glad game. And we talked about how, you know, your heart can either be sad if you look at what you don't get, or your heart can be glad if you look at what you have. And so I just started helping her remember all the good things that she got to experience that day, and I got back into it with her, and you could see her expression and her heart getting lighter again, and then pointing that out. Now look it, you made a choice, and you can help them stay focused. All right, teach them to distrust their conclusions. I will consistently say, give me two more possible interpretations to the behavior that you're defining. Yeah. You're mad at me. Give me two more interpretations. What are you saying? Well, you're raising your voice. You know, you slam something down. All right, two more interpretations. Maybe I'm mad at somebody else. Maybe I'm frustrated. Maybe I just stubbed my toe. But you've got to help them see that their conclusions are not necessarily what's true. And so playing that game helps. Here's another temperament that does not like to forgive and does not like to ask for forgiveness. But this resentment and bitterness will destroy their soul and destroy their relationships. And so please help them when they're young to learn to forgive and ask forgiveness. Okay. And then teach them to face their fears. They have fears of being wrong. They have fears of not being perfect. They have fears of people not liking them. They live in fear, and so you want to teach them to face their fears and help them overcome that. I had, again, my daughter in elementary school had a girl in her class that was as mean could be. And she came home crying all the time. I would sit down, we would go to the Bible, we would see what God had to say about it, treat one another the way you want to be treated. I'd send her back off. It didn't work, you know. And finally, this kid was mean enough, I'm like, I think I'll get involved, I'll call her mom. She said, no, let me try one more time. She invited the kid over to spend the night. For the next weekend, they became friends. And 22 years later, they're still friends. Okay, but help them face their fears. All right, developing their strengths. They have wonderful creative abilities. They're great writers. They're great musicians and artists. Help them be proud of this in such an athletic culture. Some of them are great athletes, but not all, but help them see the value of them being creative. Develop their passions and concerns. Like I say, the melancholics are the ones that make the world better, and so when you hear them have passions and concerns, help them go for that. Tap into their insight. They do think about things so deeply and so thoroughly. They're wise and they have great insight that can be great for a sanguine parent or someone else who doesn't think as deeply. All right, moving on, the phlegmatic. The phlegmatic is the kid that makes their parents self-righteous and judgmental of all other parents. Because this parent looks, their kid makes them look good all the time. I was watching a friend's phlegmatic child one afternoon, hot summer day. We were outside playing. It was hot time to come in and have popsicles. And as I was passing them out, he said, "No, thank you. I'm not allowed to have a popsicle because I didn't finish my lunch." I'm like, where did you come from? Yeah. So these are the kids that be careful about putting them in timeout, because I've heard more than one story of parents who put their phlegmatic kids in a timeout, forget, and come back 3 hours later and the kid's still sitting there. They're not getting up. Why is that so? You know, because they're adaptable, because they're observers, because they're patient, they're easygoing, you know, they're fearful, they're indifferent. I don't care if I'm sitting here daydreaming or, you know, playing with a toy. They're self-righteous. You know, they feel real good, especially if their little sibling or older is getting in trouble and they're being the good one. All right. So these are some of the characteristics of your phlegmatic child. Dealing with their weakness, help them get moving and involved in life. They're spectators. They would rather watch, but help them get involved. These kids are great kids to get into sports or into learning a musical instrument. And to give them chores at a young age and keep them in the habit of doing those things will help, because phlegmatic children can grow up to be very lazy adults, okay, and uninvolved. So work on this when you can. Help them develop opinions and convictions. It's good to give them more choices because they really don't care, and there are some things they should care about. And so help them develop opinions and convictions. If they're watching, you know, an interaction on the playground and they can judge the kids, you know, and come home and judge them and talk about how this kid's so bad, or they love to tell on kids, you know, ask them, how can you help? What can you do to solve the problem instead of just judge? Help them enter and resolve conflict. They really don't like conflict. You're not going to live through this life without entering conflict. And so help them learn to enter and resolve it. And then teach them to follow through in a timely manner. They want to do things on their own time, and they want to do it just enough to get off your back. And so have higher goals for them. With this kid, you will not be so much working with preventative sins of commission, the things they're doing wrong. But you want to look for what they could be doing that they're not doing and help them grow in that. Okay? All right. They're fearful too. They don't look like they're afraid of things, but they are afraid of things like conflict, of being wrong. And so give them, you know, scary steps to do too, and then really encourage them and praise them when they accomplish it and they see, oh, I could go to that party and have a good time, even though I'm shy and afraid to. Oh, I could speak up in class, you know, and have something good to say. Help them do that. All right. Their strengths, they are the peacemakers. They are a calm, stabilizing force. They're practical thinkers. And so they have great people skills. And they really can help a group of kids get along and enjoy each other instead of playing the catty game of I can only be your friend at this time. And, you know, let them and help them use their skills, their people skills, to move forward. We already talked about find interest and help them keep involved. All right, that's an overview of your kids. There is a temperament test online. I don't think I brought the link, but Sherry knows it, that if you want to even do tests for your kids, if you haven't figured out in general who your kid is, you can get more details. But this is what I really want to talk about. I want to deal with the guidelines of how we deal with their weaknesses. Please realize that you will need more patience with each temperamental weakness. We are not going to change them. Your sanguine kid will always be disorganized and always be forgetful. And for us to expect something from them that they're not going to give causes pain and frustration and a deep sense of my parents can't accept me for who I am. And that causes problems. In Ephesians 6:4, Paul says to fathers, I think it should go to both parents, do not provoke or exasperate your children. And when we demand something from them they can't have, we provoke and exasperate them. All right. In saying that, though, we don't want to allow them to use this as an excuse. They're going to have to live with this weakness the rest of their life, and they're going to have to manage life with these weaknesses. And so they're going to have to learn how to compensate for those weaknesses. And they can have growth and improvement. There's a difference between improvement and complete change. All right. So work through that with them, and you get a vision for how can I, you know, keep challenging them, but with patience and grace. This is where natural consequences can really help you. Then lean against judging their motives. When we have a different temperament than our kids, we tend to judge their actions and behavior through our temperament instead of theirs. That's what my kid did when she said, you're a liar. If she would have been as forgetful and changed her mind as much as I did, she would be lying to the person because she never forgets. Okay? But watch that and lean against that. All right. Then understanding the dynamic between you and your child. Know your own temperament. Understand the dynamic between the two. And sometimes God is going to want you to change instead of them. God is working on your character instead of theirs. If I would have had my way when I was a stay-at-home mom, my house would be Grand Central Station, 24/7. Anybody and everybody could stop by, parties every night. You know, it'd be awesome. And my youngest one would have agreed with me. But my oldest one and my phlegmatic husband did not agree. And they needed sometimes when the doors were locked and it was quiet. And we weren't doing anything but just enjoying the quiet. My melancholic child learned to set her alarm in elementary school and get up at 6 to do her homework because that's when it was real quiet. And she loved that and she needed that. All right. But I realized that in serving her and meeting her needs, God was showing me I did need to learn to be more quiet. I needed to have a quiet spirit. And so he was growing me as the same time he was teaching me to be sensitive to her. Explain the temperamental differences to your children. When I, for years, I worked with my melancholic explaining the differences. When I'm changing my mind, it's not because I want to break a promise, but I really thought you'd like going to the zoo more than going to the park that we go to every day. All right? But when there's that inconsistency and helping her understand from my perspective and me understanding her perspective, we really are, she's one of my best friends today. And we have a great relationship. We still bug each other sometimes, but we can laugh about it because we understand this. All right. And that helps your kid. And then allow your child's strengths to help you grow. I hate consistency. I hate to have to be on a schedule and a structure. My melancholic loves it. And she feels more loved by her dad because he spends 30 minutes with her every week at the same time, the same place, sharing the same meal because it's consistent than me, who was a stay-home mom and was with her day and night. You know, but I didn't have structure. So she taught me how to have more structure. We now have our date every Friday night for dinner. And I'm glad that I've been able to be more consistent. I'm glad she's able to be more flexible. All right, in closing, I guess the last point that I want us to know is that God really delights and finds great beauty in diversity. If your family is all different, it might be difficult sometimes, but there's going to be a richness and a beauty in that that is powerful. God also made us in His image, and so He made us relational beings. And He also said that we are His masterpieces. You know, there are not superior temperaments to others. They all have a masterpiece designed to them that we should come to appreciate. And sometimes it takes more work to appreciate than others. But that's our job, to appreciate our kids as the masterpieces they are. Because we're relational, He designed us to be interdependent. And this is one to think about. Because, you know, my sanguine kid, fearless, would go up and order anything, make all the phone calls, confront all the people for her older sister. And the older one was always talking her into, I need more ketchup, you know, for my fries. Go up and get it. I want this. Go get it. And there was a part of me that was like, get it yourself. And there's a place for that. There's a place for that. But I also realized the beauty of them meeting each other and the appreciation that it would be. And God has not made anybody perfect because He wants us to be interdependent. And so allowing for these weaknesses and teaching them how to depend on others is a part of being made in God's image, because He is three persons in one, and they have an interdependent relationship as well. All right. One thing I'm so grateful for is the fact that our God does give us truth so that we do know how to relate to them and develop them. How did I know to slow down the parties and the chaos in the house? Because the truth, God's truth, tells me to be, my love needs to be sacrificial. How do I know to fight to the end? Because I know the Bible says my kids need to learn how to honor and respect and submit to their parents. You know, so we have so much truth that really helps us and guides us on how to raise our kids. This might be for some of us today. It is for me a reminder, since I've already raised my kids and screwed them up, to some degree, not completely. God offers us His forgiveness. And when we accept that forgiveness, He gives us His Holy Spirit. God does give us a lot of truth. This is what you need to do. This is what you should do. This is what you should do. But He also knows that we can't do it perfectly. And I am so grateful as a mom who did make some mistakes in parenting that He said, I forgive you completely. And because I forgive you, I also will redeem and make good, you know, the mistakes that you made. I had an anger problem. And I yelled more than I should have with my kids. And they saw me express anger, you know. But my husband, who knew God's forgiveness and knew how God wants to redeem things, he said, "One thing I'm grateful for, honey, our kids will never be afraid of conflict." Okay. And so, of course, he wanted to help me, and he did help me calm my anger. But I'm glad he had that vision. God says that this forgiveness is actualized when we ask for it. The Bible teaches that man is alienated from God because we're sinners, and that the problem with us and his relationship and the alienation is that we are in rebellion against him. But the Bible teaches different than Christian religion and other religions that say man should be able to work their way to God. The Bible teaches that God says you'll never be able to be good enough. You'll never be able to work for it. And so I've sent my son to pay with his own life for your sins. And if you come to understand that and accept that, then I will give you my forgiveness. Our relationship will be right. I will give you my Holy Spirit to live inside you, and you will have a new source of power and love and freedom from guilt to be able to parent well. He gives us his infinite love so that we have an abundance to give. Sometimes parenting is exhausting. And when dad is busy and we are pouring out and pouring out, we can get exhausted. Instead of needing to get frustrated with our kids and need them to behave for a while so we can get refueled or whatever, we can go to God when we have a spirit and a relationship with him. He will fill us with his love, personally through prayer and his word, through other people, so that when we go to correct our kids, it's not for our good or convenience, but for their good. Okay, extra reading. These are old books. I don't even know if they're still being published, but you can find them in our library. Parenting with Love and Logic is still in print, and it is a great book on natural consequences. And then the other one that I talked about, and I don't remember the author, is Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World. All right. Do we take breaks now, or do we just ask questions? We're just questions. Questions, comments, points of clarification. If you have a real specific parenting issue, it might be better to talk afterwards, but points of clarification or comments would be great. Yes.
A friend of mine went to a counselor with her three-year-old, and she was having some behavioral issues. They told her that was too young to ask a child to say they're sorry and to know what that meant. And I just wondered, you said it was important to teach them to forgive and
right.
things like that.
Right.
I just wondered if that was also true.
Well, I don't know, but for me to disagree with counselors is pretty common. So I guess you'll have to decide whether you want to go with the professionals or me, I guess. But yes, I don't think they get it. But learning the habit of saying it, I think, is extremely important. And so I am not, and I have had professionals, people in this church that I respect, that say you can't, you know, make a kid have empathy. You can't make them be sincerely apologetic. Of course we can't. But does that mean we don't teach them? And I, you know, by two, the personality is developed. And so I'm going to lean against personality weaknesses as soon as I can and not worry about trying to make it be a heart thing. I just want the practice and the habit and then knowing what it means to do these things and then trust, you know, that it becomes in their heart. Does that make sense?
I have a question. It might sort of fall under a similar category. So I'm a real emotional person, and I've got very emotional daughters.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, I feel like with, you know, like my one child I think is a sanguine male, and then my other I think is a melancholy cleric. But I have questions about how you deal, like with my poor little sanguine male, she does have extreme emotional reactions, and they're very fast, you know, it's like quickly moves, but at the same time, it's like, I guess I don't know how to address it. Is it, because I feel like when I correct her, I think that she thinks it's the emotion that I'm correcting, and I see my kids, like, they don't know how to handle their anger, so they'll, like, hit themselves, or they get super frustrated, they have, like, an overt emotional reaction or something. But at the same time, I don't want to be like, it's okay that you throw this huge tantrum in Target. You need to get it together. You know what I mean? Like,
that's a great question and a great clarifying question. You know, we can't assume that our kids will automatically know how to respond in a mature way. You know, and so, and there's a big learning curve from the temper tantrum to, Mommy, I think I'm angry, and I need to talk about this, and, you know, okay? There are stages where if they can say, instead of, I hate you, I'm so mad I feel like I hate you, that's progression, and we praise that. Then, you know, okay, you don't hit yourself or your sister. You know, can you stomp a foot? Can you, you know, have a pillow to put down? People, the counselors, professionals will say you're still teaching them violence. But if it's a stage that we're moving through, then I think it's okay. All right. And then I think with my sanguine male sanguine, I gave her choices. If you need to just go and have a fit, then you go be alone in your room, because if you do this, you're going to spend a lot of time alone because people aren't going to be around you. When you're ready to be comforted, come on down and sit on my lap, and I'll comfort you. I used writing for the melancholic. You know, let her write out her anger and her hate mail. And then we throw it away and get those emotions out. Then we talked. Right. Of course, I got them out of the trash and I saved them for her when she was an adult. But those, it's helping them grow through and seeing that they're making progression. Is that answer? Okay. Uh-huh. Okay, who else? Yes.
I just had one. We were talking about, with the melancholy, talking about, you were playing the glad game,
uh-huh.
And that sounds really awesome when they're 2 and 3, but as they get older and you're trying to still instill that perspective, how do you work with that without it coming across as just lecturing about them being ungrateful? Does that make sense?
That
even if you're trying
sense.
To show the positives to that temperament, it's just,
right. All right, that's a great question as well. The first thing that I do, because it didn't, the glad game didn't change the temperament. 28, we're still playing the glad game in different versions. But the first thing is to let them express their negative feelings. I still will ask my daughter, are you venting? Are you just venting? You know, and then is this venting going to, is this, I call it good venting or bad venting, okay? Bad venting is I'm going to complain and let out enough steam that I can just build it up again, but I'm not going to correct my perspective on anything. Good venting is this is such an intense emotion, I need to get it out so and release it so that I can get to a more positive perspective. And so we are still talk about, you know, are you needing to vent? And if you're needing to vent, okay, is it good venting? Okay, then I can listen. If it's bad venting, you know, I don't tolerate that much. And then you validate that concern, and then I ask them, you know, instead of the glad game as they're older, it's, is there any other way to interpret what you're experiencing? And so we'd lean again saying, you're always so negative, you know, look at the bright side. That's not helpful. But a question, is there any other way to interpret that? What do you think was going on in that person's day that maybe caused them to act that way? They'll usually engage in that. Not always, sometimes. Okay, yes.
I have a sanguine 15-year-old, uh-huh. And I'm wondering if there's something you can do to help them deepen relationships. He has like 600 friends on Facebook, but no really close friends.
Thank you. But he says
every one of them is his best friend.
Yes. 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 In fact, I think I had that in my notes, and I completely forgot to put it in there that one of the important things to help your sanguine with is to have deep, committed, faithful friendships. That I don't know what you parents are supposed to do with phones, text, Facebook, computer. I don't know what you guys are supposed to do. I did not have that. We at the end, we did have everybody had cell phones when my kids were in late high school. If they were having a party, I take the phones, and some of the workers don't like that, but I would be like, can you leave your phones at the door so that we can talk and relate and pick it up on the way out? You know, now I got in trouble for that, but I did it anyway. It worked in my home. But I feel that, again, explaining and teaching the importance of it, they're helping them understand that you might feel like this is your best friend, but if you don't have any kind of consistency or faithfulness, maybe they don't feel like you're their best friend. And so dialoguing about what does a friend mean? And, you know, a friend is not just somebody who makes you feel good in the moment. So explaining friendship, teaching them that, teaching them the value of that, and then pray in a melancholic friend. Into their life. Yeah.
My 7-year-old, when I correct him, he has this grin on his face. Like, and my husband, he gets more mad, and I'm trying to tell him. I think he's nervous because he just grins. And, like, I mean, he understands, but it's really irritating. It's like, you know, so what do you, just ignore it or tell him to wipe the grin off your face? I mean, it's serious stuff, and he just stands there and he, like, has this grin. Like, what's funny, you know?
I know. You're not going to wipe the grin off. I grew up in an abusive home, and I had a brother who, even when he got his head put through a wall, he would smile and say, I'm your kid, you have to love me, so I'm not going to cry. And he just didn't grin. It didn't bother him. The thing that I think is most helpful there, and if anybody else has suggestions, please help me here, but I think natural consequences, you know, because, and so if you're correcting, and I don't know, you know, he's mouthing off or doing something that is not, he's not following through with a command, then to have in place the consequence so that he knows what he's going to do is going to be the most effective. Yeah. I had a friend who told me that her little one knew the consequence of not going upstairs to bed was to go stand in a corner. One night he said, no, I'm not going to bed. He looked at her and just went in the corner and took his time out. Yeah. So he took his time out and then went to bed. But natural consequences and imposed consequences are important. The one thing a counselor told me that I thought was really smart, because I agreed with him, but was that just because it doesn't change a behavior, it doesn't mean it's not a good consequence. All right? If there's logic, like with my daughter, if you don't talk and you just are angry and mean, you're going to be alone, so go be alone. That is good because it's teaching and instructive. You know, it didn't work all that well through certain ages, but it was a good consequence because it had a lesson involved and taught her something. And so this counselor was great. He said, don't keep switching things up. Stay consistent, because if it's a good consequence, it's good whether they respond or not. We can't control how they respond. You all are doing a great job of hanging in there today. Yes.
So would you speak to us parents who haven't challenged our sanguines before they turn two, and, you know, the feeling like, oh, I really blew it, and, you know, dealing with that.
I did. Okay. But why feel bad? Because they're, you know, what I have always said is us parents who know how we screwed up our kids are much better off than those who screwed them up and don't know how they screwed them up, because we can pray about it. We can look for the way God wants to redeem it. We can keep growing. And, you know, I do know your pain. And I did cry. And one time around a campfire, I was praising my daughter about how well she grew up, and she goes, yeah, Mom, we both did a pretty good job growing up, didn't we? You know, and I'm like, yeah, I have to admit that, yeah, it was. And she goes, but I would have never wanted to grow up with anybody but you, Mom. I'm like, okay. They will appreciate if we keep growing with them. You know, and I had to tell myself sometimes, boy, if I really screwed it up as bad as I'm feeling right now, I can't afford any more hours of self-pity, because that's just going to make me screw up more. So get under God's grace, accept His forgiveness, see His hope of redemption, and get moving. Okay? And then maybe balance off with somebody. Maybe you didn't screw them up as much as you think you did. We get in big trouble when we compare our private parenting with other people's public parenting. You know, and we think, oh, look at how patient they are. Well, you're out in public. We don't know what goes on behind closed doors. You know, look how consistent they are. We don't know what goes on behind closed doors. You look pretty good, too, in public. Okay. All right. That's it? All right. God, thank you so much that you have made our little ones the unique masterpieces that they are. Thank you that you do give us truth and insight. Thank you that it's never too late. God, you're not done changing us, much less our kids. Thank you that that's a lifetime project that you are committed to, and that you do give us the grace and power to keep growing. Thank you, God, that you know, you want our kids interdependent on other people and the body of Christ, so you don't care if we mess them up a little bit. That shows their need for you. God, I thank you that we have each other to help each other through this. And we do thank you that even though it's hard, it is rewarding to love our kids as you've loved us. Amen. Mm-hmm.